to encourage everybody, if you don't belong to the Vancouver Institute, to please consider joining. We have some really good speakers in a wide variety of topics, and it's usually a very stimulating and enjoyable way to spend the evening. And the membership for a year is only $10 for a student, and $20 for an individual, and $30 for a family. So I think it's a pretty good bargain. And we've got the usual table outside, and there are brochures there. If you don't want to join tonight, you can send your money in. In the coming season, we've got some very good speakers again. We start on January 26th with George Dyson, who is the son of Freeman Dyson, who may be more better known to you, and he's speaking on the Orion Project. And other speakers we have are Burton Richter, a Nobel Prize winner, and then someone who's familiar to everybody, David Suzuki. Our speaker this evening, as you know, is Professor Judith Myers. Dr. Myers graduated from Tufts and from Indiana universities, and then she went on to do postdoctoral work at the University of California at Berkeley. She served as an Associate Dean of Science here at UBC for 7 years, and she's president of the Society for Canadian Women in Science and Technology. Dr. Myers is a leading ecologist in this country, and her insights and work are on some currently important questions that are relevant to our well-being and to the well-being of the environment. For example, she's doing research on how to biologically control the insect pests that affect vegetables and flowers in our greenhouse industry, work that could in fact have a large economic impact. And there are examples in her work that relate to the environment. I think many of us, particularly if you live in this end of town, are aware of how purple loosestrife is really threatening the integrity of wetlands in BC. You might have seen some of the signs that are out in the park at Jericho about that. Professor Myers is evaluating beetles from Europe as a possible biological agent to control the spread of purple loosestrife. So it's my great pleasure this evening to introduce Professor Judith Myers. Judith.
Thank you very much, Pat. I'm really honored to be speaking to this group. I think for a number of years I've been coming on Saturday night and thought, gee, that might really be wonderful to speak to this audience. And then last summer I had this invitation to come and speak, and I was extremely proud. And then I was told that I would be on the 1st of December. And I thought back to other 1st of December where we often have snow on the 1st of December, and I thought, you know what's going to happen? It's going to be snowing. And you may remember on Thursday it snowed, and I said, that's it, you know, it's starting, it's going to snow, and nobody's going to come. And then this afternoon the wind was blowing, and I thought, that's it, the electricity's going to go out, and my PowerPoint's going to blow up. And then it started to rain, so thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it. So the title, as advertised for my talk, is Insects, Friends or Foes. Now, last year at this group, we had a lecture by Mark Winston on nature wars. And last week, we had a lecture on conflict resolution as sort of an alternative to war. Now, I'm not saying in any way that Mark Winston probably even picked this title, but there's a tendency to talk about insects in regard to the war against insects. It's popular to hate insects. And what I want to talk about today is, well, maybe we need to put insects in a different perspective and to try to convince you this evening that maybe insects aren't all bad. That is, maybe not all insects are bad, or maybe even the bad ones aren't all bad. Now, I have three topics that I would like to mention this evening. First, I'm going to talk about what professors do in the summer. Then a little bit about putting insects to work, biological control, and finally about the mountain pine beetle. It's the insect of the media for the last few months. What do professors do in the summer? Now, I realize a lot of you folks here have been associated with the university and you know the answer to this, but you probably have had an experience like mine, and it happens almost every year. Classes are out. What are you going to do with your holiday? Well, in case there are some people that fell into that category of asking that question, I would like to reassure you that no, as professors, we are not on holiday from April to September. In fact, if you ask my children about holidays, when you have two parents that are professors at the university, they would say there's no such thing, really, unless you're going out to count insects or birds, unless you happen to get the odd weekend. So no, we're not on holiday. One of the things that I do in the summer, which I really enjoy doing, is answering the phone calls that I get about insects. Something of this sort. My son found this insect is far too big. It can't possibly be from British Columbia. What is it? Well, we do have some very large insects in British Columbia. And we have some very attractive insects in British Columbia. And we have some rather bizarre insects. We've got caterpillars that will be as large as my finger. And when people see these, they think that, well, this can't be natural. It must be some introduced species. But no, we do have some natural caterpillars. And we have some insects which tend to look a bit nasty, but they, in fact, are very good, that they are feeding in the ground on other insects, and they're helping to clean up a bunch of the dead material that's down there. And then, I know these aren't insects. I always have to tell my entomology class, no, spiders are not insects. You can't have spiders in your insect collection. But it's another call that I get, and it has to do with the brown recluse and the hobo spider. And I thank Karen Needham, who is here tonight, for giving me the latest on this. We do not have brown recluse spiders in British Columbia. If we have hobo spiders, they're very rare, although we have some relatives of hobo spiders. And there are no recorded cases of people being bitten by spiders and suffering the effects of that. So this should not keep you awake at night. We do get spiders similar to the hobo spiders sometimes in our sinks and things, but they are not hobo spiders. Now, another type of call that we often get in the summers have to do with these ladybugs, which in the autumn come together to go off and hibernate in the mountains, and they stop on the way, particularly on the sides of houses, on the side of the psychology building a couple of years ago. So you get these huge numbers of ladybugs swarming to go and hibernate. I guess it's safer for them in the mountains, and so they overwinter there. The next spring, they come back, spread out, and go to the fields where they eat a number of aphids. Now, I want to tell you next about my favorite caller. I'm going to remember this woman. I wish she were here. If she is, you could identify yourself. This woman had been visiting. This was about 1997. She'd been visiting on Sydney Island, indicated here by the red arrow, which is just off from Sydney, British Columbia. And it's a marine park. And what she saw there were caterpillars everywhere. And it's a bit hard to show this. I've indicated by the red arrows this tree that is covered with caterpillars. It makes it look all sort of fuzzy. And this is the sort of thing that she was seeing on Sydney Island. Well, these are the Western tent caterpillar. And they're one of my favorite insects. And I have been studying them now since 1975. Western tent caterpillars have a single generation a year. They spend most of that year as egg masses on our trees. In April, they emerge from the egg mass and begin forming these little silk tents. And if they're on our backyard apple trees, they can make a bit of a mess. When they're at very high densities, they can make an even larger mess. Now, what is interesting about tent caterpillars? Well, first, they have population outbreaks, so approximately every 9 to 11 years, we have lots of them. They have viruses, they have diseases, and they are able to hear. And I want to tell you about these three aspects of tent caterpillars as being something I do in the summer. Now, way back in the 1930s, the Canadian Forest Service began monitoring a variety of insects in British Columbia and across Canada. And I have indicated on this graph, in the red arrows, the years in which outbreaks of tent caterpillars have been recorded. Starting in 1975, then, on a small island near Sydney, I began monitoring these populations by counting the number of tents on the island. So the data from 1975 on gives you an estimate of the populations based on counting the number of tents. And we see that you get these outbreaks that are separated by 9 to 11 years in the 60s, in early 70s. There were a couple of cycles that were a bit shorter, and then back to a 9 and 11 year cycle. So this is one of the questions that I and my students have been working on. Why is it that they go up and down with these sorts of patterns? Why is it some years you don't see a single tent caterpillar and other years they seem to be everywhere, particularly if you're in the area of Saanich Peninsula or on the Southern Gulf Islands? Now, I just wanted to show you what it looks like. This was June 1997 on Galliano Island, and you don't see any leaves on those alder trees. What I've indicated with the red arrows are tents of the tent caterpillars. Those little black things are groups of several hundred caterpillars. And the yellow area indicates one group of caterpillars on the trunk of those alder trees. So in some years, they can absolutely defoliate trees in areas. Now, if you went and looked at some of those tents in the Galliano area in that year, you would have here on the left a pretty sad-looking group of caterpillars. And then if you look in the center picture, you will see what one of those looks like up close, and you see that it's sort of oozing goo. And if you took some of that goo and you took it into an electron microscope and looked at it, you would see all these little balls. And then if you blew up those little balls, you would find these virus particles in there. So this is what we think of as the Ebola virus of the tent caterpillar world. This is a type of virus that's absolutely specific to the caterpillars and absolutely devastating to them. What we see is happening with these population cycles is that when the densities are low, the caterpillars are large and healthy, and they lay large egg masses. This, of course, leads to population increases, and when they get to be very dense, they group together, they eat contaminated food, and they begin to spread the virus. During the declining populations, we see animals that are dying, like I just showed you, or small, sick-looking, they lay few eggs, and the population declines. So this is one aspect, then, that helps to explain why some years we have lots of tent caterpillars and other years we have very few. Now, can this virus be used as a biological insecticide? The answer is yes, it can, and it has some real advantages. One is it's very specific to particular species of caterpillars. Therefore, we can use, say, a virus against the tussock moth and not have any impact on butterflies who might be in that same area. The other thing about using these viruses is if you get an infection going in the population, then it can persist for several years. So spraying one year can lead to infection the next year. It has been used very effectively on tussock moth in British Columbia for the last several outbreaks. It is a bit expensive to develop, but I think that some of the beneficial aspects of it mean that we should be looking at this a bit more. And this is one of the things we're interested in trying to develop maybe for the caterpillars in greenhouses. Now, the next story I want to tell you about these tent caterpillars is how caterpillars can hear. And this happened early on in the study when we were out on this Mandarty Island, my husband, Jamie Smith, and I, and it was high population density, and we saw things like this group of caterpillars sitting on their silken tent. And I had a cold at the time, and I happened to cough, and what I discovered was that the caterpillars began waggling their heads back and forth. And this made me very curious about what sounds they were responding to, and Jamie and I did a study in which we got a recording with different frequencies of sounds, and we went out and tried to test what frequencies did these caterpillars hear and respond to the greatest degree. What we found was that there is a fly that attacks these caterpillars. It lays its eggs on the head of the caterpillar, these white things there below the fly. You can see the eggs. And of course, the caterpillars don't want to have these eggs laid on their heads. I don't know why that would be so, but what happens is that there are little fly larvae in those eggs. They hatch out. They go into the caterpillar, and then eventually, instead of getting a moth coming out, we get flies coming out. So this is one of the parasites that kills the tent caterpillars. Therefore, if you have a fly coming across that group of caterpillars sitting on their tent, they respond to this by waving their heads back and forth. And of course, this really puts the fly off considerably. So it seems to be then a response to hearing these parasitoids approaching the group, and they respond as a group and very effectively prevent parasitization. So I thought this was really neat observations. We published a paper on this and things. And then several years later, I was in Prince George talking to a school class, and a young chap came up afterwards. I was telling this story, and he said, you know, my grandmother told me about that. Tell you about putting you in your place, you know. He said, this is sort of native tradition, and what you're supposed to do is go up to the tent caterpillars, in this case, the forest tent caterpillars in the northern areas, and say, ha ha, sanakwa. And I thought that was really interesting, because ha ha has those same frequencies as me coughing at these caterpillars, or the sort of 2,000 frequency that they respond to. So this caterpillar is shaking its head back and forth. That's why it is blurry. Yes. So this woman ended this phone conversation by saying, I'm really happy that the university has people studying these sorts of things. And that really made my day. I think often we sort of think that what we do is maybe viewed as being extremely esoteric. What are those people doing out there at the university? We're paying them all this good money. Well, it made my day. The next little bit I want to talk to you about, I think of as putting insects to work. And this is biological control. Biological control is one way of dealing with introduced weeds and insects. Two major threats to our natural biodiversity are habitat destruction, cutting down forests, planting fields, building houses, and introduced plants and animals that come into our natural systems and change them, sometimes in a serious way. Now we know that the Europeans in particular have been very great invaders, and I look around this evening and I see that many of us share that same invasion capacity. So not only did we come in as humans, but we also brought with us many of the plants and animals which we were associated with in Europe. Not only did the Europeans come to North America, of course, but also to South America, to Africa, and to Australia. And in all of those places, the most major weeds and insect pests are originally from Europe. More recently, we have had a considerable amount of inflow of trade from the East, and with that has been another wave of invading species. How are these plants spread? Well, first of all, a lot of them were brought in accidentally with hay and in seeds such as alfalfa seeds that were brought in the early 1900s to British Columbia. Ship's ballast, in which they put soil in the bottoms of the ship at the port to balance it, and then when they got to the New World, they would take this soil out and dump it around the port, and the seeds of the plants that were in there would get started and spread. But I think one of the most disappointing things to me is the number of introduced species that have been intentionally introduced. Some of them were for medicinal purposes. When the Europeans came to North America originally, they brought many of the plants that they knew had some sort of medicinal value with them and planted them. The number of ornamentals, the trade in ornamentals is just amazing, and this is another way that not only have invasive species come in, but are still coming in today. And then a number of species were brought in and planted along roadsides and other places to prevent erosion. So 85% of our most serious weeds were introduced on purpose. And this is sort of typical around the world. So we have met the enemy, and it certainly is us in this case. What happens when these plants come in? Well, a large portion of them tend to begin to take over. And this is a picture of English ivy and growing on a tree similar to what you might see down in Stanley Park. English ivy brought in for the army base there and now has escaped. Another introduced species you might be familiar with if you're a bit of a gardener around here, and that's bindweed, which I'm always fighting every summer. And another weed which is just getting going now in British Columbia and is going to be a major pest, I think, is knotweed. You can see this in the endowment lands. The picture on your right there actually is a picture taken from Britain where it has had a head start, and it just totally overgrows. And if you happen to come down the power line through the endowment lands, it's beginning to spread from there. Other parts of the endowment lands, it's really getting started. And the GVRD, I think, is interested in trying to do something about this, but it is an extremely difficult weed to deal with. So what can we do with these species then that are invading? And this is where I think that maybe we could put the insects to work. In their native habitat, plants will have a number of natural enemies feeding on them. This means that they are under a bit of stress. They tend to have low densities. And they aren't quite as good at competing with the other plants that are in that area. When they get introduced to the exotic habitat, in other words, they've come from Britain and now they're in British Columbia, they don't have these natural enemies. Therefore, they're really superior competitors to our native plants that do have their natural enemies. And they grow large and they become very dense and they become serious weeds. Biological control then is to try to reestablish on these introduced plants some of the natural enemies that they have in their native habitat. Is biological control safe? Well, before any insect is introduced, it is tested to make sure it does not feed on our agricultural crops or on closely related species even that we value in some way. I think biological control of weeds has been particularly good about this testing and making sure that they don't introduce other problem species. It's not been quite so good for biological control of insects. Although, even though there have been careful tests done, sometimes we change our attitudes about plants and then we do have some non-target impacts. For example, St. John's wort was viewed as being a serious pasture weed for years and years, and then somebody discovered that it seems to be relatively good for treating depression, and so now you can buy St. John's wort locally. Now people are concerned because biological control was successful on St. John's wort, and now people want to grow it as a crop. So sometimes the value of plants change, and this can lead to some problems down the line. But the weed that I wanted to talk to you about was purple loosestrife. And this is one that we have been working, my graduate student Madeline Denoff and I, on the biological control of this wetland weed. Purple loosestrife is of European origin, again, and it was a medicinal plant. It was first discovered in British Columbia in 1880, so it has been around for a considerable time. It's only, though, probably in the last 20 years or so, been really spreading rapidly into our wetlands. And part of the problem with purple loosestrife is until just several years ago, it was being sold as an ornamental for gardens. So one would go out, for example, along the Fraser River, and you'd look one side and you'd see it in people's gardens, and then you'd see it coming into the Fraser River Park as a monoculture. So what does purple loosestrife do? Well, it becomes so dense that it is poor wildlife habitat. It displaces the native vegetation. It slows down the flow of water in these wetland sites, and then it begins to change to dry land. So because it reaches these high densities, it is considered to be detrimental. So what can we do? In 1992, we began introducing insects on the purple loosestrife that were imported also from Europe. Now, these insects, as I said, had been tested carefully to see what other plants that they would feed on. It's a little beetle that feeds on the leaves. On your right-hand side, you have the larvae, and on the left is the adult laying some eggs. But they're tiny little beetles, but they are voracious. And this is some of the damage that they do. First of all, the larvae go for the tips of the plant, so that's good because it begins stopping the growth of the plant. And then they feed on the leaves, causing these shot holes. And the damage can really turn the leaves just sort of crispy and dry. Now, down at Jericho was one of the first places that we introduced these beetles in 1992. And it really has changed considerably down there from what was almost a monoculture of loosestrife to dead plants and now to other plants. Unfortunately, what's coming in there is not native either, and that is this grass, the canary reed grass. So it looks different, but whether it's any better, it's hard to say. So we are still working on distributing these beetles to other places that have dense stands of loosestrife. And part of the research that we're doing is to try to find out why they work so much better in some places than others, because although they've been effective in a number of areas, they haven't worked everywhere. So biological control, insects can help reduce introduced weeds, and we hope by doing this that they will help restore natural biodiversity. It's a problem if you have another exotic species that introduces or comes in right afterwards. Now I wanted to talk about the mountain pine beetle, the species that has been in the press a lot, starting maybe, I know last June anyway it was, and last week it was. So this is an electron microscope picture of the mountain pine beetle. And in 27th of June, practically the day that Gordon Campbell was inaugurated, this was the headline, mountain pine beetle epidemic panics British Columbians. British Columbia, I guess. I didn't know. Did you feel panicked? Did you? An epidemic infestation of mountain pine beetles is ravaging. They like to use that word ravaging with insects. You watch for it. British Columbia forests, destroying trees worth billions of dollars to the provincial economy. And heaven only knows we can't have that. So this was the headline last week. Pine beetle surge risks billions of dollars. Again, we value things in terms of billions of dollars. Since 1997, 5.7 million hectares of lodgepole pine have become infested with beetles. This was from the news last week, and an estimated timber loss of $6 billion. I want to start by just sort of reviewing for you a little bit about the biology of the mountain pine beetle. We have up here on the left the little beetle flying, and they fly in sort of mid-summer, June, July. And what happens is that a few individuals, few males come in and they find a tree that they think is susceptible, and they start burrowing into it, and they release a chemical that attracts other beetles to the tree, and pretty soon you have a real party going on. The males and the females mate, and when they begin to get the feeling there are too many around, they produce other chemicals that begin to repel other individuals so it won't get overcrowded. The females then lay eggs underneath the bark of the trees, and these eggs hatch and they begin to develop into larvae, and they burrow through these galleries. You can see there galleries with the dark things are the adult beetles, and the little white things at the bottom are the larvae. The life cycle of the mountain pine beetle looks something like this. As I said, the adults are flying in July and August, and the females lay eggs after they mate about that time. And the larvae then need to develop to a late stage of development if they're going to be resistant to winter temperatures. So it's important that they have a warm enough period of time so that they can get to be a relatively mature larva, and that is how they overwinter. In the spring, they will go through the pupal stage and then emerge as adults again. So there are two periods of this life cycle that are particularly sensitive to what the weather is doing. There is the summer weather, when if it's warm, they're able to grow rather fast. And then there's the winter weather, where if you get an extremely cold spell early on, say October or early November, the larvae are not yet cold hardy, and so that they can be killed by that cold spell. So this might feed into what happens to the beetles. Now there's another little trick that these beetles play, which is pretty clever, and that is that the adult beetle carry a fungus with them. They carry the spores of this fungus so that when they burrow into the trees, this fungus gets going and it begins growing, and it's called a blue stain fungus because it stains the wood, but it also shuts off all the circulation in the tree, and that is a major factor in actually killing the tree. So it's this neat association then between the insects and the fungus and the tree. Trees die, and if you've driven past Manning Park, you have seen this. But if you look at that picture, you see that not all the trees die, because some of the trees are still resistant to the beetles. So what determines an outbreak of these bark beetles? Warm summers help them get going by allowing the adults to get started early and to lay lots of eggs. Old trees are very important because they are less resistant, and this is shown in the graph at the bottom of the page there, where we have the resistance of the trees indicated as related to the age of the stand, and you can see that once you get about past 90 years, the trees really are low and resistant. Actually, they start becoming more susceptible to beetles when they get to be about 60. And another thing that really can get these beetles going is if you have very even age stands of trees, so that there's lots of them in that age group that's above 50 years old or up by 80. You get even age stands when you fight forest fires, so you don't let these patches develop in the trees. So this is a picture that shows how the stand age is important. Old trees are attacked and killed by the beetles, and the younger trees can be resistant and continue living. Now I put together some of the data that were collected by the Canadian Forest Service to show you that there have been other outbreaks of these beetles, and this is from the Cariboo region. And you can see that in about 1983 through 82, 83, 84, there were large areas of the Cariboo infested by beetles. It's really quite interesting because that outbreak was not limited to just the Cariboo. In fact, there were outbreaks in the early 80s all the way from Prince Rupert to Nelson. So across quite a range of different forests, pine forests. Now I've also indicated on this graph years which had relatively warm springs. 1978 had a warm spring and summer. It also had a cold snap later that year. And that was still when the populations really began to increase. 1985 in the Cariboo area, populations declined. And that was associated with a real serious cold snap in October. Again, it was relatively warm in 1992, and that might be where this more recent outbreak began to turn around. There was a cold spell in 1995, and then extremely warm temperatures in 1998, which could have caused the outbreak that is causing us so much press time at the moment. Now, I want to point out something to you here, and that is that these data stop in 1995. Since 1910, the Canadian Forest Service had a program called the Forest Insect and Disease Survey that monitored what various populations of insects were doing, what their diseases were doing on trees. In 1996, that program was stopped. Now here we are, we're global climate change, the time in which these long-term data are really becoming important to have, and priorities have changed with the federal government, and that program no longer goes on. Yeah, we're still out there, you know, we go to where there's problems. But I just point this out to you because it's the type of attitude sometimes that is very frustrating to us biologists. So is this pine beetle situation then an ecological disaster? Well, it depends, I guess, on what sort of time frame and how you look at it. It's a natural system. It's been going on for a number of years. It's one way of rejuvenating the forests. It allows, by getting rid of these old, large trees, it allows the undergrowth to develop. And in many of these places, there is an undergrowth. Maybe it isn't even pines. Maybe it's spruce or fir. But it allows those trees then to take off. And another of the interesting connections in all of this system is that fire is a major part of it in two ways. One is if we did not suppress fires, then we would have more of a patchy mosaic. That would mean that the beetles would maybe not spread as far when they do go into outbreak. But the pines are well adapted to having fires, and their cones are released, the seeds are released from the cones when you have a fire go through, so it's sort of necessary to get reestablishment of these lodgepole pines in these areas. So it's a system that has evolved for years and years and years. That's the way it has worked until we have come and said, hey, we want those trees first. We want to cut them down. Is this an ecological disaster? Well, can this type of an outbreak be suppressed? And this is what we see a little bit about in the literature, that if we had had enough money, we could have suppressed these outbreaks, is what certain people say. And well, one of the ways maybe you can suppress it is by going in there and cutting down the trees before the beetles, you know, have a chance. And again, if you have driven the highway through Princeton, you will have seen this type of an operation in action for a number of years. Those clear cuts just on the far side of Manning Park are beetle control areas. Now, yes, that probably works, like right along the highway there, that's great, but when you think about these outbreaks occurring in little patches of dead trees here and there and the other place, what it's going to require to go in there and cut out those trees is putting a road through. There are all sorts of ecological impacts of maybe being able to suppress these outbreaks. Another question you might ask, you see this truck, okay, that was taken during the winter, but it's got these trees, maybe they've been cut down from this area, and you wonder about the beetles that are in there. You know, are they flying away as the trucks move along, or from the places where the logs are being taken? So there are these environmental costs then associated with these programs. Building the roads, creating clear cuts, and removing wildlife trees. My colleague Kathy Martin tells me in the Williams Lake area, the woodpeckers think they've died and gone to heaven, because now there are all these trees with beetle larvae in them. What is the value of lodgepole pine? Well, I've been talking to people about this because I wanted to see what they had to say. Two people have said, before IKEA, it was a weed. Now, those are probably not independent. And I began thinking about this situation last week, and my colleague over in the Fisheries Center, Daniel Pauly, has become very famous for his idea of how what we're doing is fishing down the food chain. So, you know, if you don't get salmon, then you pick up a rockfish on the way home, and if you don't get that, you buy some prawns at the store. And he points out that, you know, as the fish go, then we end up taking lower and lower quality of fish, and then we get down to the other invertebrates. Well, this made me think about maybe that's what we're sort of doing in this situation here, that we're logging down the timber chain. Cedar, fir, very highly valued trees. We've taken them out of the areas where they're easy to get, and so now pine and aspens and even alders are becoming more valued. So maybe when we look at these billions of dollars that the pines are valued as, maybe that's because we have already overexploited some of our other trees. This is just an idea, and I'm happy to argue it with the foresters, if there's any here. So the economic considerations in all of this problem, the value of those trees, these $6 billion, $7 billion, $8 billion, depends on how good the markets are for the trees and the availability of the wood. I don't know where they get these figures. It would be worth looking at. The economic consideration also is what is the cost effectiveness of control programs. Yes, you could probably do these things to try to slow down the spread of the beetles, but we really have to evaluate that in terms of the long term and how much that is going to cost us. So I'm throwing this up. I might have said conclusion, and I'm not going to do that for you. So this is for your consideration. For your consideration is the idea that beetles and pines in the presence of fires have evolved over thousands and thousands of years to rejuvenate forests, and that management should consider this natural cycle for maintaining a mosaic of forest ages and types to try to work with an understanding of how the beetles are going to respond to provide forests in the long term for future generations of foresters. So in conclusions overall, these are the things I want you to take home if you would like to tonight. First of all, insects are and can be neat. Insects can be helpful. I could spend hours here telling you about other ways in which insects can be helpful, but as biological control agents. And finally, insects have evolved with forests, and we must keep their role in perspective when we look at a defoliated tree or even if we look at a dead tree. I'd like to end with some acknowledgments. First of all, to my mentors, Dennis Chitty and Charlie Krebs, my students past and present, my family, Isla, Ian, and Jamie, who have been out there counting caterpillars and digging plants, a number of different resources that provided some of the figures tonight, whether they knew it or not, Canadian Forest Service, Jesse Logan, John Borden, Kathy Martin, Sue Glenn, Alan Carroll, and Karen Needham, and then particularly for the Purple Loosestrife work, we have had funding from a variety of different sources for which we are appreciative. And now I wanted to leave lots of time tonight for you to ask me questions. And you can ask me questions about West Nile virus, winter moth, gypsy moth, insects and global warming, malaria, cabbage loopers, or anything else you want. And I just want to to share with you this quote. I came back from the field last summer when the beetles were just, a columnist or somebody from the newspaper had called my lab and said, was I there? No, she was out in the field. Well, does she know anything about bark beetles? And my student said, well, she may not know much, but she will have an opinion. So I'm glad to share my opinions. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Okay.
I don't understand about the fires, so can you just go over that bit again?
Okay, well, the fungus is carried by the beetles, and then they introduce it to the trees when they begin burrowing underneath the bark. And then the fungus actually grows on the tree, and what it does is it suppresses it begins to kill the tree. What it means is that then the tree is less able to reject the beetles from the tree. So it's slows down the sap, and so it makes it a better tree for the beetles, and then the beetles are able to survive and grow better in that situation. The fire is associated with the trees that once they have been killed by the beetles and the fungus, they just become more likely to burn, and it depends on what sort of stage it is when the needles begin to, or have fallen off, and there's lots of them around. There's a period of time in which they're very susceptible to fire. Then they go through a period of time where it's not quite so susceptible to fire, and then when they fall over, then they become more susceptible to fire. So it's all part of the system. When the fire goes through, then the lodgepole pine cones open, seedlings drop out. There's now lots of nutrients because the fire's gone through, and they do well. Well, yes, I'm sorry. So the question is, what should the forest industry do? And you know what comes to my mind first, and I maybe shouldn't say this, but I know that my kids have this saying, and it's you know, suck it up. You know, I know that there are lots of pressures, and there are communities that are dependent on that wood for cutting. But I think that what we have to do is to try to put this into perspective, and then when we put a value on the trees that is 8 million or 6 million or whatever, we're saying that every one of those trees belongs to us and we should be able to cut it. And my feeling is that maybe we should step back a little bit and say that we are evaluating this wrong, that we should be sharing these, they're not all for us. And we should be maybe trying to keep them out of some areas where it's particularly sensitive. There are things you can do. You can go in and you can thin the trees and they become more resistant. But it's this attitude that we, you know, that we as humans have a right to species or to try to eradicate. We have that attitude that we can knock them out. I think they should be looking at what the ecology of the system is and say, how can we best work within that evolutionary and ecological situation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, John.
Judy, I'd like to invite you to reflect upon the three major outbreaks we've had of disease since 1975. You talked about Nelson, you talked about the caribou, now we're in the Quesnel. Mm-hmm. Something about this sequence of lodgepole pine becoming susceptible to the beetle. Would you like to reflect on what was going on in the province?
Oh yeah, this is, yeah. There was burning, when the white people first came in to British Columbia, and particularly during the gold mining era, these trees were just nothing but a pest. So the way to clear the land and get in there, whether it was for agriculture or for prospecting or whatever, was to burn the forest. What this did was created quite even age stands that are now really, really ready to go. And so this is part of it. The other interesting thing is that we have had other outbreaks. As I said, in 1985, there was, across the province, there was an outbreak. And I assume that what's happening there is a certain age of trees are getting hit, and those are mostly being killed. Or in some areas, you get the cold weather, and then things quiet down for a while, and then they come back again. But it's interesting that it is across the province. There is this sort of sequence. Is that? Do you want to add more to that?
I'd just like to say that your idea of a mosaic of age classes is right on the line.
Thank you.
That's what we need, and we need to manage these even age classes to bring them into a mosaic. Okay?
John's a forester. Oh, another forester. Yes, sir.
Kind of follow that up. If you want to create a mosaic, there's several ways of doing it.
Clear cutting's good.
Clear cutting does it. And if you fly from the Nicola Valley over to over east of Roma, you see a lot of packs logging. And so you have a bunch of stands that are very young.
That's right, and there are, and certainly the forest practice has gone more that way. There's another type of mosaic, and that is to have young trees coming up underneath old trees so that you get the old ones cropped off and then the young ones have a chance to come back. So I think and it's different things in different places. Some places they are more homogeneous lodgepole pine, which isn't particularly good for the wildlife. Other places they're more mixed. Yes.
Which has gone wild like a person purple loosestrife, brings to mind the fact that because the exotic has gone wild, you have to bring in another exotic insect to control it. I'm concerned about the sustainability of biological control in general. One quick comment. The introduction of the plant that is the water hyacinth all over the world is now being controlled by a beetle from Venezuela at great cost, and one wonders about the sustainability and the cause and effect. I'd be grateful for your comment.
So the question is this whole idea of bringing in another exotic species for the sake of controlling an exotic. And in some cases, this is used in many, many parts around the world. Although in some places, the water hyacinth is working extremely well, I think, in biocontrol. But can I answer this, or you wanted to add something? That's the question. What I wanted to say was I agree with you totally. And I am very strong in my opinions about how many biological control agents we should bring in these situations. And I have some colleagues who feel that you should keep bringing in a number of species and increase the pressure on the weed until eventually it declines. And my research and that, again, of some of my students indicates that if you look at successful biological control, it is usually one species of insect that has been successful. And I think we should be doing more research to try to find out what it is that will really have an impact on the plant before we bring it in. And that's why I was involved with the purple loosestrife, because I saw the work that had been done in Europe. I saw that when they had disturbance and the loosestrife came in, these beetles came in and attacked it, and it reduced the density, and I thought it really had potential. And I was very adamant about only bringing in one species, although they're now four or five, and they've been introduced in other parts of North America, but not here in British Columbia. So I agree. I don't like the idea of bringing in one exotic for another, and yet, because these exotics can have so much impact on our natural vegetation, I've been convinced that it's worth trying to do something. Okay? Yes?
I have a hard time imagining ladybugs migrating.
Yep.
I never knew they did that.
Well, that's right. I mean, some Octobers, you know, if you're right place, you'll see them, and it's just amazing. And they fly, as I say, up to the mountains. So they can fly probably several hundred kilometers at least. And birds do not eat them. You know, they're bright red, and they are distasteful, so that they're safe from birds at that time. It's amazing. And how do they all get together? I don't know. Is there, again, some sort of chemical that groups them together? It's amazing. Yeah.
Maybe I have a lazy bird, subspecies of ladybugs. I've got probably a dozen sitting in the corner, but I think it's easier to get my nose on it if they're not.
No, that's not unusual. This gentleman has ladybugs living in the corner of his house, and thank you for leaving them there. There are some species that do this more than others, and some species, there's an introduced species now that particularly in the east is just causing lots of problems because it loves to go into houses, and not everybody is so happy about sharing, particularly if you've got thousands of them. I guess it's a little bit, yeah. Your pets, those are pets that don't feed. You seem to have something you want to add here. Yeah. Up in the back?
Up in the back?
You, yeah, okay.
My question is, how long do butterflies live?
They probably, as adults flying, can live for maybe a month or two. So they sort of lay a few eggs and feed on nectar, and so, yeah, relatively long-lived. How long do butterflies live was the question. Some of the moths, for example, just live overnight. So there's quite a bit of variation. Monarch butterflies live a long time because one of their generations, anyway, flies from Ontario all the way down to Mexico, where they overwinter, and then they come back up to Florida, where they will have their offspring the next spring. So they are living for months. And some of the tropical butterflies, again, can live for a number of months. So there's a lot of variation, but I think our northern ones probably live a couple of months. Yes, sir.
My question is about mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
The breeding cycle of a mosquito is, I believe, 5 days. So
well, first of all, can you control mosquitoes by getting rid of wet areas where the larvae are able to develop? And different mosquitoes have different types of wet areas that they like. And for example, the mosquitoes that carry the West Nile virus do like to have little bits of water. They like bird baths. They like a tin can that has some water in it. They like the drippings from air conditioning, that type of thing. So certainly in that situation, one of the recommendations is that around urban areas, you can get rid of these sorts of breeding sites by just being very vigilant on not having any sort of place to collect water. West Nile virus, of course, is still totally in the east, not a concern out here, but yes, you can do that. I think it's really hard around here to get rid of all the sort of wetland places where mosquitoes can breed. But yeah, there are some that you could probably reduce. I mean, we're really lucky here in Vancouver anyway, not having very many mosquitoes. Yes, we have mosquitoes that can transmit malaria in British Columbia. Whether they're very common, I don't know, but if that's what you were asking about, the Anopheles. Yes. Okay, yes.
Which species should be or could be established and maintained in the urban garden environment?
Species, like a good species, like a predator species, yeah? Well, I think the best thing to do is maybe not concentrate on a single species, but to try to create your garden that is conducive to a lot of different sort of predators. So you have a sort of a mixture of vegetation around, you have some flowers, so those things that need some nectar will have them to feed on. If you don't use insecticides, you'll have lots of good species that are there. So we do have ladybugs that come in, we have the lacewings that come in that will feed on the aphids. We have these ground beetles that are feeding on a variety of different things. We've got spiders galore, as you probably noticed in August. I mean, spiders are very good predators. So it's mostly, you know, trying to, this is my rationalization for having a messy garden. I think that's better for those species. Yeah. Is there concern about the killer bees? I think it's unlikely they will ever get, all the models that I have seen says no, that they won't get this far north. So no, I wouldn't, I would stay awake at night on that one. Yeah, you feel better now, yeah. Yes, sir. There's some consideration about what might happen with some of the diseases that are transmitted with mosquitoes. And that's got to do more with the warming and how rapid those cycles go with the malaria organisms. But I don't know of any really, I think it's still quite uncertain. For example, there are some models that say that warming is going to cause an asynchrony between when insect eggs hatch and when leaves develop in a way that's going to be detrimental to the insects. So we might have less insect outbreaks of some of the defoliating caterpillars. Other models say that the warm temperatures will reduce the overwinter survival and then we'll have more. I think it's going to be a lot of variation from species to species. And warmer is not always better for insects. I think that's the case. Yes, sir.
Some insects travel far long distances from north to south, so we say. Has anybody got any ideas how they navigate?
Yeah, I'm sure they do. How do insects navigate? Some of it might be just picking up the right wind patterns. Some of these things, what they do is they take off and they get up quite high, and then, you know, if there are certain wind flow patterns, they end up, and it really looks like that in some cases with these, some of the agricultural pests, like they just get dumped in somebody's field. They're certainly on a smaller basis. Some of them are able to use sort of magnetic fields to direct themselves. Things like the bees are able to use the sun. Some insects probably use polarized light to be able to orient. I think there's a lot of different ways, and every single one of them is extremely clever. Yeah.
You mentioned that your cough triggered those caterpillars in the back of your head.
It was in the sort of the lower frequencies. It was like 200 to 500 cycles per second, which I'm not sure we're supposed to use cycles per second anymore. And so you can tell this study. Yeah, but how's a hertz? Can somebody translate that for me? The same. Oh, thank God for that. Okay, 200 to 500. So it's relatively low. I mean, it's sort of like you can hear it quite well. Insects fall into two different groups. There are those who have direct flight muscles, and that means that their wing beat, although relatively fast, is still slow as compared to another whole group who have indirect flight muscles, and that means they use the sort of tensile strength of the whole cuticle. So things like flies have relatively low, flies and bees all are in that lower 200 200 to 500 hertz. And then things like, I was thinking about the bumblebees, and then some of the wasps and the smaller insects have a much higher buzz, which we can't hear, really. And the caterpillars didn't respond to anything that was way up there.
What was this particular kind of fly that feeds, right?
Yes, it is. It's a parasitoid fly. It's in the family Tachinidae. And I'm going to forget, it's Tachinomaia. Names are not ever my forte.
Just the one of our several types of flies? Just the one type?
No, the one, there's one major one that lays its eggs on the head of those caterpillars, yeah. There are certainly other parasitoids, other flies, other sizes, and certainly the caterpillars did respond to other sounds. That particular island had a gull breeding colony, and they would sometimes respond to when they squawked, and so that, no, there weren't that specific, but anything in that range, they really seem to get them going. Who's going to ask me, how do they do that? You're going to ask me how to do it? No. somebody who hasn't asked a question. We have two people asking a question. I don't think you have asked. Yeah, so, well, there are two types of things that are attacking honeybees. What is attacking the honeybees, and what is that problem? There are mites, so, you know, little tiny mites, and one group are called Varroa mites, and the other group are called tracheal mites. Now, insects breathe by having these little tubes that bring the oxygen right into their bodies, so they don't breathe through their mouths or anything. They have these little tubes, and those are called trachea. Those get filled up with these little mites, and it's very detrimental to their health. Both of those are introduced pests. Of course, the honeybee is introduced as well. And so you get these in your colony, they just begin reproducing, the vigor of the hive goes down, and they don't overwinter well, and sort of all over. Is that good enough? Or did... Oh. They're working on some things now that do seem to suppress them quite well. I mean, I think life would be much easier without the mites, but I think that they're coming up with some things. I mean, it's very difficult because you can't put a regular old insecticide in there. And some of the things that they're looking at are essential oils, you know, things like clover oil and things like that that are edible or whatever, and they seem to have an effect on these mites. So I think that they're learning a lot more about how to rear bees in the presence of these mites, and that we'll get better and better at it. Yeah. Well, bumblebees have probably been impacted by the competition with the European bees and also by the use of insecticides and things like that. And I think that one of the, maybe the positive things about the situation with the honeybees is that some of our native bumblebees might get a better chance now to, and I know that there's lots of interest in looking at other types of bees as pollinators of crops, and particularly the species of bee called the alkali bee, which is being used in blueberries now. So I think that you get a problem like that, and it forces people to begin thinking more broadly and thinking about other species and things. So again, it's not all bad. Yep. Yes, I'm sorry. What about gypsy moth and spraying with BT? We have had a number of introductions of gypsy moth to British Columbia since 1978 was the first one. And gypsy moth is introduced to eastern North America. Every time it gets relatively high in the east, then we get it in British Columbia. And the approach to this has been, once a population becomes well established, to go in and spray it with a bacterial spray, BT, Bacillus thuringiensis. And in 1992, there was the spray of Vancouver for the Asian gypsy moth. And at that time, I spoke out against not the BT, which I think is an extremely safe, it's a microbial insecticide, but against spraying so much of Vancouver when the population was a bit more localized, then maybe it was necessary to spray all of Vancouver. So I think BT is an incredibly powerful tool to have in our toolbox. I think that probably it is worth to buy time by suppressing these sort of local introductions of gypsy moth, but we're just buying time. I mean, they're going to get here. Well, they're here. And how much impact will they have? Will they devastate our forest? Absolutely not. Will they attack our oak trees that are already being attacked by winter moth? Yeah, probably. So yeah, again, it's got to be in perspective, yeah?
Are spiders generally tolerable for us and useful? Mm-hmm. Well, I understand there's one species that's quite deadly.
Well, that's what I mentioned. The two species we get calls about all the time, the brown recluse and the hobo spider. And neither of those, well, the brown recluse is not supposed to occur here at all. And the hobo spider, if it does, is extremely rare. And so I wouldn't worry a lot about it. If you're in Australia and sticking your finger down the tunnels for the funnel spiders, that would be a totally different thing. But no, I wouldn't worry about it. I mean, I wouldn't play with spiders, and I don't even like spiders, but not to panic. Yes, I am. I'm part of a biological control network that was finally funded, but it was a real battle to, because we couldn't go out and say, oh yeah, Dow Chemical is going to chip in, you know, so many hundreds of thousands of dollars. The question was, am I hopeful about more alternative insecticides for use and controlling insects, I guess. Things like these virus are good. There was a company back east that developed a virus product to use on the Bertha armyworm on canola, which is a major pest in Saskatchewan. It would have been quite safe, went through all of the development, and then the financial backers just pulled out. Extremely difficult to get the sort of funding to take these things all the way through to development because you don't have a product at the end that's going to make you millions of dollars. And the whole idea that what's good about it is that they're specific to particular pests, and that means that you're not going to have an enormous big market, and so you're not going to have a big profit. So it's very, very difficult. We have British Columbia, I think, was one of the forerunners in developing insects to be used for release in greenhouses and other places as predators. And the greenhouses in British Columbia really attempt to the best that they can to grow without pesticides because for each species, they have these natural predators and things. If you use pesticides on one, it really disrupts it. And that industry in particular, I think, has really gone that direction. Good idea. They're dirt working on it. And maybe you can talk to John after. Yeah, but there are experiments, and it does seem to work. She asked, what about using that chemical that the pine beetles use once they have enough beetles around to repel other individuals? And I'm saying that, yes, the research is going on that, and tests are being done. And it looks like it has some potential, but in any of those situations, if you're talking about, you know, 100,000 hectares or something like that, it's a bit difficult. If you have particular trees that you need to protect for whatever reason, because they're in your backyard or whatever, it probably has potential. But yeah, you should talk to John here. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, what about the role of the media in all of this? And I think that is really an important factor. And I guess that the media is responding to what people respond to. So if you had a headline that says, there's lots of pine bark beetles in Williams Lake, oh, okay. But if you say, you know, so many billions of dollars and so many millions of hectares, war on, battles beginning, you know, people panicking, that seems to be what we as humans need. So, I mean, I think that it's really very difficult to find that in-between stage. And I think that what it requires is, mostly for folks that are reading the newspaper, to think, now where did that $6 billion come from? How did they figure that? You know, and you can do the hectares. It's no problem measuring hectares infested, you and the trees are dying and you fly over and you can measure it. But who puts that value on there when we've got what seems to be, you know, too much wood that we can't sell anywhere else? You could say that that wood has no value and probably be just about as correct. Yeah. Yes. Cabbage looper? Cabbage looper is a pest of a variety of crops that you would have in your backyard. They love cabbage, they love Brussels sprouts, broccoli, they will eat your lettuce. yeah, particularly the broccoli. But they have been going into these greenhouses, which is a nice environment for them, nice and warm and stuff like that. And so they have become one of the major pests of cucumber, pepper, and tomato. Now let me tell you why they're a problem. You know these, you go to the supermarket and you get these peppers, and some supermarkets have them wrapped in plastic, and I won't buy those, but you know, these lovely peppers. Well, if you have too many droppings from these cabbage loopers in the top of your pepper, and you take it to the, wherever the co-op where they sell them, they'll throw them away as being unacceptable because they have those little black things in there. So, I mean, I don't know. It doesn't matter to me if there's little black things in there. I wash the pepper anyway. It's not toxic. But there is this high standard which somebody is saying that we as consumers have, that means that they have to spray with this BT spray once a week in some of these greenhouses so that their cabbage looper population is so low that the peppers don't have little droppings in them. We call it frass in the insect world. So, yeah, they're a bit of a problem, but some of that problem we create. Well, I'm still not sure it's us, but the perceived consumer demand for absolutely clean vegetables is dictating some of the use of these things. Oh, what am I going to do? Yes, you haven't. We better. Okay, this is the last one. I don't quite know how did I get an interest in entomology? And it's one of those very difficult questions to answer because I still remember being in high school and having to do an insect collection. So you put these things on pins and I could hardly do it. I mean, I just touching those dead insects was just really hard for me. My first job was a lab job doing histochemistry, which I found incredibly boring. I met some people who worked on butterflies in Trinidad. They said, did I want to go with them to Trinidad? And it was all history.
I'm going to ask Professor Dennis Chitty to come and thank our speaker.
Ladies and gentlemen, Judy Myers has been very cunning. She's chosen to do her pure research on organisms which have an obvious economic importance. Now, other studies of this nature do not have the obvious commercial interest attached to them, and this leads to a good deal of criticism sometimes. Of course, to this intelligent audience, there's no need to defend research which is undertaken purely for the sake of increasing our understanding of the world around us. But other less enlightened people who don't come to the Vancouver Institute sometimes have strong objections to this kind of research. Some of you may remember that about 5 years ago, a local member of parliament took strong exception to some fundamental research being done by a colleague of mine, Lee Gass, on hummingbirds, and he took a number of cheap shots at it. Now, Judy would, I think, be the first to recognize that much of her success is due to the fact that she has been preceded by a number of pure scientific studies. We could start with Charles Darwin, who spent many years studying the lowly earthworm. We could refer to Charles Elton, who spent his career founding the pure science of population ecology. And oddly enough, it turns out that Charles is a marker gene for genius in ecology. And it turned up for a third time right here in UBC in a student named Charles Krebs. One of his other claims to fame is that he was the supervisor of Judy. And although she is lacking the Charles gene herself, I think we'll agree she's doing very well in spite of this handicap. So Judy, thank you very much for a most instructive and enjoyable lecture.